We are going to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. Looking at the story of Joseph. Let's go ahead and read this chapter. And we'll come back and take it apart. There's no way that we can deal with everything in a chapter like this. These stories have so much that's different to our way of thinking. And so much that comes into play into the story. We can only kind of skip the stone across a story like this. But we need to get it in our mind as we get started. Genesis chapter 41, verse 1. After 2 whole years, or 2 days of years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows, attractive and plump, and they fed on the reed grass. Behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin cows ate up the 7 attractive, plump cows, and Pharaoh awoke. And he fell asleep and dreamed a second time, and behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on 1 stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump, full ears. And Pharaoh awoke. And behold, it was a dream. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "I remember my offenses today. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged." Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. When he had shaved himself, changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've had a dream. There's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, in my dream I was standing on the banks of the Nile. 7 cows, plump and attractive, came up out of the Nile and fed in the reed grass. 7 other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and thin, such as I had never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the thin, ugly cows ate up the 7 plump cows. But when they had eaten them, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were still as ugly as at the beginning. Then I awoke. I also saw in my dream 7 ears growing on 1 stalk, full and good. 7 ears withered, thin and blighted by the east wind, sprouted after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 good ears, and I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me." Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty ears, blighted by the east wind, are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine." This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot. They called out before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh. Without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly. And he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and he put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. And Joseph stored up the grain in great handfuls, in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, "God has made me to forget all my hardship and all my father's house." The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph. Do what he tells you to do." So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. This morning we want to look at getting to know our God. And in getting to know Him, getting to love Him. You know, Valentine's Day is obviously a special day at many different levels, but for many, Valentine's Day is a disappointment. For many, it represents what they're longing for all through the year, a joy through commitment, intimacy, security, companionship, but they dismally lack it. Perhaps for this reason, the season above all others seems to be so cheapened by its commercialization, it offers fantasy experiences in absence of the deeper realities. But for those who are in a committed, self-sacrificing, a deeply enriching relationship, Valentine's Day highlights a truth that may lose some focus throughout the remainder of the year, but it's the sustaining gem beneath the surface of the relationship. That is, to know a person, or to love a person, is to know that person. You can't really love a person unless you get to know them. And the deeper the knowledge, the greater the love. That's why fantasy can't compare with reality, because the more you get to know the fake, the less you love it, because of the absence of the real. As we get to know others more, we move from knowledge about them to knowledge of them. We don't just know about that person. We actually know the person themselves. This difference is highlighted in Psalm 103, verse 7. It says, "God made known His ways to Moses. He made known His acts to the children of Israel." The significance lies in the difference between God's ways and God's works. The difference between what God does and what God is. God's acts, what God does, are always based on God's ways, who God is. And getting to know God, it says Moses knew who God was. And as he's entering
entering the promised land in Deuteronomy, he says, God, I've only begun to get to know you and your ways. Please, please let me go in. I want to see more of you. And God says, no, no, you've blown it. I think maybe I can illustrate it for you this way. Early on in our relationship, I learned that I did not want to mess with my wife when it came to water. In the first time that my wife came over to our house for a Sunday dinner, I made the mistake of teasing her while she was taking a drink. And shortly thereafter, both myself and the wall behind me were baptized with water. That was a work. Okay, that was an act. That was something my wife did. But what she does is she makes you pay by not getting even. She gets ahead. I found that out about my wife. I got to know her. And as I got to know her, I got to understand her ways. That is who she is. I got to know that she's extremely competitive. I got to know that she's fun and spontaneous. And that combination frequently keeps me on my toes. So consequently, she does what she does because she is who she is. And so the better I get to know my wife, the more I get to anticipate when to duck and when not to duck. Okay. Consequently, after 20 years of marriage, I love my wife more deeply today because I know my wife more deeply. Not just about my wife, I know my wife. You know what I'm saying? Okay. And as we do life with God, the whole purpose of doing life with God is to get to know God better. And we understand that everything God does flows out of everything that God is. It seems so basic, and it is, but we tend to forget it in the middle of life. Proposition this morning is simply this: our God's ways are meant to reveal who our God is. What's our God like? Well, let's look at what our God does. It gives us some examples of what our God is. What we want to see today is that this passage gives us five basic ways in which God introduces us to His sovereignty. God is absolutely, unconditionally in control of everything in your life and in mine, in this world as we know it. God is absolutely in control, and this passage helps us to see in five basic ways the ways in which God introduces us to this sovereignty. In verses 1 through 14, we see that our God is sovereign, and He delights in manifesting that sovereignty through divine reversals. In the first part of this passage, we see that God exercises His sovereignty in the divine reversal of making needy those who are without need. Pharaoh, the highest man in the world at the time, a world power in Egypt, and the top man in the top country in all the globe. And God brings him to his knees by helping him to understand his need. We start out the story here. We see Pharaoh dreams. Why did Pharaoh dream? Well, God brought him a dream. We find out, Joseph says, God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. This is a dream that's brought to Pharaoh by God. He dreams this dream, and he's disturbed by it. It says there in verse 8, in the morning, his spirit is troubled. We see up at the end of verse 4, he wakes up. We see at the end of verse 7, he wakes up again. Something's going on here. You ever have that dream where you wake up and things aren't right, and you're thankful that you did wake up, because if you didn't, you were in some pretty dire straits. You ever have that dream where you're falling off of something? And you, whoa! And you wake up your wife, whoa! What? Oh, good. I wasn't falling. Pharaoh's falling, and he can't get out. Something's happening. He wakes up. Ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. What was that? And the first time we're told the story, we're told about these lean cows and these fat cows, these sleek cows, the ESV calls them plump. They're attractive. They're the fatted calf in a very real way. Then these ugly cows come up. They're thin. And Pharaoh kind of expounds on it a little bit more afterwards. He says, these things are so ugly, They're worse than your mother-in-law. He says, these things are bad, ugly. And after they ate up these cows, get the picture here. He sees these seven fat cows come up out of the Nile, and they're munching on the reed grass. They got their heads down. And then all of a sudden, these other cows come up behind them. And it doesn't say they eat the grass. They're standing there. Kind of a weird thing. You see these cows just standing there, kind of like looking over at the other cows. I wonder if the cows in the dream were kind of like eating and then like looking over their shoulder like, what's going on, ugly cow? They're just eating and eating. It's this ominous scene where all of a sudden these ugly cows, without eating any grass, eat up the cows. It's like, whoa, weird. That's strange. And he wakes up because of it. He's like, that was bizarre. Goes back to sleep. He's got these, we don't know what kind of grain it was, whatever grain it was, probably not ears of grain, maybe heads of grain. It could have been wheat, it could have been some kind of a corn, whatever it was. He's got these large kernels, these large heads of grain. And then all of a sudden, it's these other skinny, withered, blighted grains swallow up the grain, and they've been roasted by the desert heat that's been blowing across the desert. These things trouble him. He wakes up and says, what in the world is that about? It's interesting that these dreams take place on the banks of the Nile River. We don't have anything like it to be able to understand what the Nile River meant to the nation of Egypt. But the Nile River was at the center, or at the epicenter, if you will, of its entire economy, of all of its agriculture, of everything that they were, of all their great power as a world power in the world. The Nile was at the center of it. The New Bible Dictionary says it this way: except for the Nile and its inundation, that is, its flooding and bringing the silt and mud and the richness of the river to the that valley there in Egypt, Egypt would be as desolate as the deserts on either hand. Wherever the Nile waters reach, vegetation can grow and life can exist. In fact, it says that sometimes the difference is so stark that you can stand with one foot where there's vegetation and one foot where there's desert. That's how stark the contrast is within the land of Egypt because of this Nile River. The way the Egyptians understood the Nile was that because of the rhythm of the floods and the recesses, the wet and the dry, it brought a balance to life that they could bank on, that they could depend on. And because it was so regular, they didn't go through the famines that other ordinary lands would go through from time to time. This was so regular. And they tied all of their, not just their economy, but even their worship to this river. The gods of the Nile were powerful gods, and they were represented by none other than Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh, who was kept trim and sleek and in the robustness of health. And as Pharaoh fared, so fared the land of Egypt. And if Pharaoh would become anemic and weak and sickly, the entire nation would look at him and say, whoa, the gods aren't happy with us, because our Pharaoh is becoming sick. And as it happens to Pharaoh, so it will be with us. And they start looking at the Nile and saying, you know what, the balance, the ma'at in our system, in our worldview is being rocked at its core. The Nile was at the center of this balance for them. Pharaoh's troubled. He realizes that he has a need. In verse 8, he says, my biggest need is that I don't have somebody to interpret these dreams. He brings Joseph out of the prison. He says, Joseph, I don't have anybody to interpret these dreams. He tells the dreams, and at the end of the dreams, he says, Joseph, there's nobody to interpret these dreams. You can feel the kind of ramp up as he repeats it three times. There's nobody to help me. I've got a need, and there's nobody who can meet my need. And for crying out loud, I'm the Pharaoh. I shouldn't have needs. But God has introduced me to the fact that I am a man. I'm a man who's in need. You know what? We don't like it. None of us do. To be brought to that place where we realize in a brand new way how much we're needy. I think of the different things that God brings into our life. Sometimes it's pain. You can do things so normally, and then all of a sudden God just allows some little pain. And all of life is different for you. You can't walk. You can't think. You got headaches. You got back aches. You got leg aches. You got whatever. And pain just debilitates you. Sometimes it's a financial struggle. You've had freedom to be able to make different choices, and all of a sudden God crunches you in one area of your life. Man, really? I can't do this by myself. Maybe it's a relationship that God allows you to struggle with, and all of a sudden you're at this place where you say, you know what, no matter what I say, it all backfires on me. I can't do anything right. Those are precious times. They don't feel precious to us. They feel painful. They feel hurtful. They take away our independence. They strip us to the core of who we are. And that's the whole point. Because God delights in taking those who think they have no need and revealing to them their need. And God says, why don't you turn to me? Because I'm the God of the great reversal. I'm the God who can meet your need. I'm the God who longs to meet that need. But not only does God make needy those who are seemingly without need, but God removes the needs of those who are very needy. And Joseph stands opposite Pharaoh in this narrative. Joseph is secure. Joseph is in a prison. Joseph is a servant of servants. Okay, he's lower than low, and Pharaoh is higher than high. Pharaoh is troubled in all of his successes. Joseph is confident in the life that he's living in the pit, in prison. Two contrasts. But God takes Joseph and he exalts him, though he's a servant of servants. We see in verse 12 that the butler here says, remember the time when your servants were put into prison? This Hebrew servant served us as our servant. Pharaoh, there's a guy, you wouldn't know him. He's not just a level below you, he's like levels below you. But he's a guy who stands out in my mind. This servant of servants, he's a servant of Potiphar, he's a servant of the chief butler. Joseph's about as low as you can go on the feeding chain in Egypt. But Joseph in this narrative is remembered, though he'd been forgotten. It starts out the whole chapter here in verse 1. After 2 whole years. The Hebrew is after 2 years of days. And isn't that how it goes when you're in the middle of struggling? It isn't like this chunk of time, 2 years. It's like 2 years of stinking long days after day after day after day after day. 2 years. Joseph had hoped that maybe in getting in with the chief butler who stands in the presence of Pharaoh, maybe he would remember, and he asks him to remember him. He says, hey, when you stand in front of Pharaoh, remember me. I'm not here because I'm supposed to be. I'm here because I'm not supposed to be. Remember me. And for 2 years, he's not remembered. But all of a sudden, as this narrative begins to unfold, it says, in the same night, Pharaoh had one dream, two dreams. It seems like God's not working, not working, not working, not working. And then all of a sudden, brrr, and God's working just like it's cascading. One after, you ever been there? God's like, you're waiting, you're asking, you're praying, you're crying and waiting and crying and praying and asking. And all of a sudden, bum, 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 wow. And you can't hold it all. And God didn't forget Joseph. God remembered Joseph, even when the man butler forgot Joseph. And we see that this goes back even before that, because in the end of this, the butler says, you know, Pharaoh, God's brought you to a place where you've realized your need. your greatest need is you need somebody to interpret your dreams. Let me tell you about this guy. He knows how to interpret dreams, it says in verse 12. And in verse 13 it says, "And as he interpreted to us, so it came about." I mean, this guy can't just tell you the meanings. He tells you what's going to happen because of the meaning. And it happens. It like actually happens. This guy is an amazing. He's like a master of dreams. Interesting. The master of dreams is the phrase that his brothers used when they saw him coming. They were back in Dothan. They said, "Oh, here's the master of dreams." Literally, the word is, here's the Baal of dreams. The small g, God. The master of dreams is coming. Let's throw him in the pit. And here the butler says, "There's a master of dreams in the pit. You need to grab him and bring him here into the court. He can help you." I don't know if you've looked at it recently, but back in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 2, Hannah. Hannah is a lady with some serious needs. She's one of two wives. The one wife who's barren. The other wife has several children. And for years and years and years, she longs for a child and has none. She longs for just one, while the other one has another and another and another. And not only is it the embarrassment of not having one, it's the shame and it's also the pain of being mocked for not having any children. And they become competitors, and she becomes kind of crushed under the heel, if you will. Finally, God gives her a child. And in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, she says, "God, you're the God who gives life to the dead and takes life from the living. You're the God who takes those who are in the ash heap and puts them on the throne and takes those who are on the throne and puts them in the ash heap. You're the God who delights in manifesting your sovereignty through the great reversal. You're the God who in an instant can raise up or tear down because you alone are God." That's an important point. It seems so basic. But we tend to forget that, don't we? God is God. I'm not. God is God and my boss is not. God is God and finances. God is God and nothing else is God. And God delights in showing his sovereignty through divine reversals. We see in the next section that God confronts man by proclaiming his sovereignty. Joseph's called out of the prison. Verse 16. Verse 15, Pharaoh says, "I've had a dream. I've heard it said of you, when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Joseph answers very quickly. These are the first words out of Joseph's mouth. "It's not in me. I can't do it. Nope, wrong guy." These are the very first words. They're stunning when you think that these are spoken to Pharaoh. "Say, I hear you can tell dreams." "Not me. I can't tell any dreams. But God can. God can tell you the dream." In fact, he says he'll give you an answer. The idea is, how does the ESV put it? "God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer, an answer of shalom." The idea of shalom is pertaining to his welfare. God will answer you with regard to your welfare, the question that's on your heart, the question that's troubling you. God can give you an answer which will either tell of something good or something bad, but it'll settle the question that's in your heart. And it's interesting that this dream gives both good and bad. And we're not told that God is angry or pleased. It just tells us that both good and bad are about to happen. He says in verse 25, "God has revealed to Pharaoh what God is about to do." Pharaoh, you've got plans, you've got committees, you've got envoys, you've got people who are trading, you've got building projects, you've got all these different things laid out. You've got, you know, everything that you as a Pharaoh are supposed to do and want to do and want to accomplish. You've got your political agenda in hand, okay? Let me tell you God's agenda. And let me tell you something. God's agenda will trump your agenda. When you stop and think about it, this is an absolutely brazen thing that Joseph is saying. Pharaoh, king, I'm here to tell you that you're not all you're cracked up to be. You don't have as much power as what you thought you did. You're not as in control as what you think you are. There's this other entity called God who has an agenda, and God will accomplish his agenda. It says the same phrase both in verse 25 and 28. God has revealed to Pharaoh what God is about to do. Throughout the Joseph story, we have many sets of twos. Two pits, two robes in the middle of the stories, two dreams, two trips from Canaan down to Egypt. These twos kind of come together. The fact that this statement occurs in this climactic pericope, the fact that it occurs twice, means that this is the very heart of this narrative. God is about to do what God decides to do. And you're not going to stop him, whether you like it or don't like it. This is what God's going to do. It says in verse 32, the thing is fixed by God. God will shortly bring this about. Why is that such a challenge or a confrontation, if you will? We don't understand, again, what a Pharaoh is. He's not like the president. He's not like the prime minister, if you will. He's not like any politician that we would know or understand. He's not even like a tyrant. The Pharaoh, as we referenced before, was understood to be the son of the god Re, who was the sun god, one of the strongest gods in the pantheon of Egypt. He was the incarnation, if you will, to borrow a term from the New Testament. He was the Messiah in a secular sense. He was the Messiah of this society. He was the one who the sun rose with and set with on his shoulders. He was literally believed to be a god. And so here's Joseph standing in front of this Pharaoh, perceived as God, and saying, there is a God, and you're not God, and he is. And what he says is going to happen. That's an amazing thing. That's a scary thing. That's a bold thing. It's an exciting thing. And God confronts man with God's sovereignty. A third truth about the way God introduces himself is that he regularly exercises his sovereignty through his servants. At the end of that passage here, we see that Joseph gives some ideas. Here's what you need to do. Because there's going to be seven good years, and then seven bad, you need to gather up all that food. Let's take about a fifth of it. I did the math. Why wouldn't he just take a seventh? You'd take one seventh, and then you'd have that for each of the 7 years. But he takes extra, and other lands are coming in to buy from him. He says, let's take a fifth every year and store it away. Now, you need to set up somebody over the land, and then you need to give him others who are under his charge who can take in and count up and keep track of and keep guard over all of this excess and surplus, these taxes that we're taking from the nation. But as it's laid out for us here, we see that the proposal that's given acknowledges Pharaoh's legitimate authority. In verse 33 and 34, Joseph says, here's what you need to do. Pharaoh needs to select a discerning man and a wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Pharaoh needs to proceed to appoint the overseers over the land and over Egypt. Pharaoh, this is your responsibility. You're not God, but God's put you in the position that you possess. Okay? And as the one who's been put there by God, you have the responsibility to do this. It goes down a little bit further, verse 35. Let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food for the cities. Let them keep it. Literally what's happening there, it says, Pharaoh, everything that's in your hand, everything that God has put in your hand, everything that you're responsible for, okay, this is your moment. Here's what you need to do. And the amazing thing is, Pharaoh says, yeah, because like, there's a God, and I'm not him, and this is what God says, so this is what God's given me to do. I'm going to do it. What an amazing thing. This idea of God putting in the hand, we saw back in chapter 39, where Joseph, Everything that was put in his hand prospered. Everything that was put in his hand prospered. Okay? And then that cloak is taken from him and it's kept in the hand of the evil woman. And that which Joseph is entrusted with succeeds. And that which the woman snatches in her hand, she deceitfully uses against him. And still God causes everything that is in Joseph's hand to prosper. An amazing thing when you stop and think about it. Does God need you or me? He doesn't. God could do very well, thank you very much, without us. Without entrusting us with finances, without entrusting us with education, without entrusting us with relationships, without entrusting us with the gospel. God could do this whole thing all by himself. But that's not the way he chose to do it. God chose to make you and me in his image. And faltering though we be, he gives you and me a realm of responsibility. And he says, okay, I've put this in your hand. I want you to serve me with it. What are you going to do with it? I want you to recognize that I'm God and you're not. This belongs to me and not you. And so when the thing starts falling apart in my hand, I start to get all anxious and say, no, I can't let that which is under my hand fall apart. And I forget, you know what, this is really God's thing, and he's letting it fall apart, and I'm just stewarding this mess that he's given to me at this moment. And God is going to put it all back together for me. The proposal that's given acknowledges Pharaoh's legitimate authority. The proposal reveals it's the working of God. In verse 37, Joseph makes the proposal, and the proposal pleases Pharaoh and his servants. And he says, you know what? This comes from God. Why did they accept it? Because they're pretty smart people and very humble, all by themselves, right? They've just been confronted and said, there's a God and you're not it. And they're just good people by themselves, and they accept it. God was working in their heart. God was preparing them for the message from God. He says, you know what? We need to do this because God's been working in their heart both to will and to do of his good pleasure. The proposal that's accomplished is accomplished by God through Pharaoh, verse 39. So Pharaoh says, since God's shown you all this, there's no discerning as wise as you are. You shall be over my house. And he says, verse 41, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Well, thank you very much, Pharaoh, because you're in a position to do that. But really, did Pharaoh put Joseph over all the land of Egypt? Yes, no, God did, right? God's the one who did it. He did it through Pharaoh. And when Joseph is over the land of Egypt, we see that God's purpose is accomplished by God through Joseph. See, we're reminded again, this story is primarily the story of God, not the story of Joseph. Joseph has a role to play. Pharaoh has a role to play. You and I have a role to play, but this is the story of a God who's in control and writing a story and introducing mankind to himself. We see, fourthly, that God introduces us to his sovereignty as he desires us to see life, both the past and the present and the future, in light of his sovereignty. Verses 50 through 52. Before the famine came, two sons are born to Joseph. He's been given a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest at On. It's Heliopolis. It's the place where the sun god Re, it's his capital. It's one of the three primary cities in all of Egypt. This is a very high and influential marriage. God gives Joseph two boys that he names with Hebrew names. This signifies the greater reality of the Hebrew God than the Egyptian setting. This signifies the greater reality of the working of God than the working of man in Joseph's life. Now because of this marriage to this Egyptian priestess, if you will, there would be some political pressure on Joseph to name his boys with Egyptian names. Politically, that would be a savvy thing to do. He says, you know what? Politics or no politics, I'm remembering my God when I look at my boys. Manasseh. He says he names his first boy Manasseh because he has caused me to forget. Two things God has caused Joseph to forget. He's caused me to forget my hardship, the oppression, the bad things that have hurt me in the past. And he's caused me to forget my father's house. Not as in not remembering them, but the idea is God has allowed me to forget all the bad that they have done to me. You know, those are the two hardest things for us to forget. When bad things happen to you in life, you tend to hold on to them. You tend to pamper yourself by going back and licking those wounds. It feels so good to feel sorry for ourselves, because when life has got us down, and we can go back and say, it's all their fault. It's all because God let this bad stuff happen to me in the past. What kind of a God is this God? And God is saying, listen, I want you to know what kind of a God I am. I can take all the bad, all the ugly, all the things that have hurt you, and all the people that have hurt you. And I want you to understand that behind all of them has been my control over your life. You? What kind of a God are you? Go ahead. Ask me that question. What kind of a God am I? I'm a God who loves you enough to let you hurt, but not enough to keep you hurting. I'm the God who is the God of all comfort. I am the God who is the God of peace, a peace that passes all understanding. I'm the God who's willing to have my heart broken because I've laid all of your iniquities on my perfect, sinless Son. That's the kind of God that I am. I know heartache. In fact, I sent my Son to endure the heartache, to go through the inequities, to go through the injustice, so that He can say, lean on me. I know what you're going through. That's the kind of God I am. And God says, I want to take your past, and I want to color it through my sovereignty. I'm a God who isn't just allowing good, but I allow good and evil, and I bring good out of evil. And that brings us to the second name, Ephraim. He says, and he named him Ephraim because he has made me fruitful. Look at the end of the phrase there. He's made me fruitful, verse 52, in the land of my affliction. We're in a land of affliction. We're in that period of life where it's hurting, where people are against us, where life is against us, where it feels like God is against us. And what do we pray? God, get me out of the land of affliction. Don't keep me in this vice grip. Get me out of here. Let me loose. Turn me away from here. Put me back in Canaan. Get me out of the pit. But Joseph makes a very great realization in this moment. He says, you know what? The place where I thrived the most was the place where I was hurting the most. And in the place of my affliction is the very place that God has decided to bless me. What a paradox. Only God can do that. Now, some of you have some stuff in your life today that it stinks, it hurts, it's not fun. You would trade it with anybody. But it's the place where God is designing to bring fruit in your life. Not a rotting fruit that stinks with bitterness, but a fruit that savors with the glories of heaven because you're allowing Him to have His perfect way. You think of the cross. The greatest injustice ever done, the deepest hurt ever been committed, yet it's brought forth the most fruit ever. And that's what our God does. He's the God who desires us to see the life, past, present, future, in light of His sovereignty. Finally, our God is sovereign, and He always acts in accordance with His word. Verse 53. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt finally came to an end. 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said. Joseph said it because God had said it. It says, the famine is severe in the land of Egypt. The famine is severe in all the earth, as this chapter winds up. In all the earth, it's severe. And as the severity of this famine begins to move forward, it had been forecasted by God. And the severity of the famine moves across the earth, and it says, and all the earth came to Joseph to buy grain, dot, dot, dot. And the next chapter says, including his brothers. And they bow down to Joseph as they come to buy grain. That was the whole tension at the beginning of this story, wasn't it? Joseph has these dreams that he's going to be in this position of authority. It was given by God. God said they would bow down to him. They say, yeah, right, over my dead body. But God said, yeah, let's get rid of this guy. Dreamer of dreams. We're just going to get rid of him, and then we'll be rid of our problems. But they would bow down to Joseph because God had said they would bow down to Joseph. You know what? Our God is sovereign. He shows that by reversing, by making those who know no need to know need, by making those who only know need to have no needs as they find their satisfaction in God. He's a God who proclaims his sovereignty, and as he does so, he confronts us as we think we have our own agendas. He's a God who exercises his sovereignty through us. He entrusts us. He puts things in our hands. He's a God who wants us to see life, past, present, future, in light of the God that's in control of every detail of my life. And he's a God who always exercises his sovereignty just the way he said it would. God has given us this book for us to get to know him. And day by day, he does things in our life. Things that we understand, things that we don't understand. Things that we like, things that we don't like. Because he's helping us to get to know him. Our God's ways are meant to reveal who our God is. In fact, everything that our God does is meant to introduce you to who our God is. Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus. What an amazing God. A God that can take all the bad in my life and use it for good. A God who never forgets what he's promised he'll do for me. A God who remembers when everybody else forgets and remembers me even when I've forgotten him. What an amazing God. A God whose steadfast love is for us and not against us. This is our God. What an amazing Valentine. What an amazing love.